Thank you, Melbourne. As always, the roles and rules items are a little more mundane than some of the activities that go before it, but we do have to get them done. So Melbourne referred you firstly to 2.9 on the agenda, which was the procedure for obtaining 25% support of the General Conference of Elders for a matter that was placed on the agenda for the General Conference of Elders. Perhaps I could preface what I'm saying here, not just for 2.9, but for the other matters of the Roles and Rules Committee. When we send a paper out, we make two assumptions. The first assumption is that you will read it ahead of the council meeting, and the second assumption is you'll have a copy of it with you, either in hard copy form or electronic copy form when we do discuss it. So I'm not intending to hand out a hard copy, hard copies of the matters we're going to deal with now. But the first one does relate to a process for members of the General Conference obtaining 25% support from the General Conference for an item to be placed on the agenda of each annual meeting, of the annual meeting. The comment in the agenda says the Council approved the draft procedure at a teleconference on June the 16th. But later advice from Larry Darden suggested a bylaw amendment might be needed for this to become effected. Our Roles and Rules did consider Larry's advice and accepted it, and we did send to you an amendment to the paper that was approved, or the document that was approved at the June the 16th teleconference. I'll just briefly tell you what the change involved. The first part of the document that you approved on June the 16th was a proposed letter from the Council of Elders Chairman to the members of the General Conference explaining that a procedure had been developed by the Roles and Rules Committee of the Council and it was now being provided to the General Conference for their comment. We did not change that letter as a result of Mr. Darden's input regarding the necessity for an additional bylaw, but we did include a note in the letter. And this is what we added. The adoption of a process to facilitate the obtaining of 25% support for a proposal will require an additional article in the bylaws of UCGIA. To assist in your consideration, we have included with this communication the bylaw amendment that will be required if the process is adopted. The additional article also mandates a separate process for any four council members or any officer of the corporation requesting an item be placed on a meeting agenda, but this is not relevant to the 25% support process. At our meeting immediately prior to the council meetings, that is the committee meeting prior to the council meetings, we did discuss the matter of creating a procedure whereby any four members of the council or any one of our officers could, in fact, have a procedure in place for them to place an item on the agenda for the annual conference. And that is the reason that note I just read to you does refer to the four members of the council or an officer of the corporation. But during our discussion at the committee meeting, we agreed that writing a procedure to allow any four members of the council or one of the officers of the corporation to place an item on the agenda for the annual meeting went far beyond simply the procedure itself. And so we decided we would defer that particular part of our discussion and just come back to dealing only with members of the General Conference seeking 25% support to place an item on the agenda for the annual meeting. So that note that we added to the proposed letter from the Council of Chairmen from the Council Chairman to members of the General Conference does need to be changed, and I will read out to you how it will read. It says, the adoption of a process to facilitate the obtaining of 25% support for a proposal will require an additional article in the bylaws of UCGIA. To assist in your consideration, we have included with this communication the additional bylaw that will be required if the process is adopted. So that is the only change to the letter that you approved at the June the 16th teleconference. Everything else remains as is. However, if you look at the second page of what we sent to you around about the middle of August, We included on that second page the wording of the proposed new bylaw article that would be required. It was a new article, 7.9.2.2, the process for submitting agenda items. And it was in two parts. The first part referred to the process for 25% of, seeking 25% approval, and the second part related to the four members of the council or one corporate officer. Because at our committee meeting, we determined that dealing with the process for the any four members of the council or an officer should not be included in this current proposal, we have deleted out of that new article, which is on the second page of the document, the second paragraph of that article. So the proposed new bylaw article that will go out with this documentation says this: 7.9.2.2, process for submitting agenda items. Requests to list items on a meeting agenda, when submitted by 25% of the general conference, shall be presented in accordance with a process proposed by the Council of Elders and approved by a simple majority of the General Conference. So that will go out with the letter from Melbourne to give them an idea, or give them not an idea, but an actual copy of what the new article would be. The process that you approved for members submitting these amendments, or seeking, I beg your pardon, seeking to get 25% support for an item to be placed on the agenda of the General Conference, has not changed at all. All that has changed is the covering letter, which we're going to get the Chairman to send out, plus the addition of the proposed new article. So all I'm asking here is for the approval you gave for Melbourne to send out that letter with the attachment of the recommended procedure can go out now, but with the amendments that I've just outlined to you. So that's all we need you to do. Just say, yes, please go ahead and do that. Nothing is being decided here. This is going out to the General Conference, the procedure, to say, this is how we think it can happen. There is no procedure at the moment. This has caused great difficulty in the past when somebody wants to gather 25% support. So here is a suggested procedure by which this can be done. Let us know what you think. When we get their feedback, we will then be able to put finally a procedure together, send it out again to the General Conference, because it is a General Conference matter. It is not a council matter. They will then say, yes, they'll ballot, they'll accept that procedure, and from then on, that will be how any member of the General Conference can seek 25% support to have a proposal placed on the agenda for the annual meeting. So, gentlemen, all I'm asking is for your okay to give this revised letter to Melbourne, include the proposed new bylaw article with it, send it out to the General Conference for their comment, and await for those comments to come back to us. So if you have any questions or any doubts about what I've just given you, I'd be pleased to hear them. Gerald.
Just a question then. Will I assume then that this will be an amendment supported, sent in by the council?
Yes, it will be. Yeah.
In January, December, you'll submit the...
Yes, if we can get this out to the General Conference imminently, we'll have it back in good time for the new article to be put to the General Conference at the next annual meeting, yeah.
So the process goes out with it?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Everybody happy that we go ahead with that? Good. Okay, the next item we can deal with is 2.13, appointment of Deputy Chairman of the Council. At the moment, of course, we don't have a Deputy Chairman. We have just the Chairman. The Roles and Rules Committee was asked to consider whether such an appointment, that is the appointment of a Deputy Chairman, would be beneficial. And we did submit a report to you. The Roles and Rules Committee looked at that, submitted a report to you. Because it's a brief, I will, in fact, read to you what the council, what the committee said. The report was headed, Deputy Chairman for the Council of Elders. And the background was that the council retreat held immediately following the May 2011 council meeting, the matter of whether a deputy chairman of the council should be appointed was raised. The Roles and Rules Committee was asked to consider the matter and report back to the council. The reason the matter was raised was a heavy load upon the current chairman, and that he is frequently out of the country and away from reliable telephone and email access. It was proposed that assistance in preparing for meetings, such as following up on outstanding items, assembling agenda, and ensuring relevant documentation is submitted on time, would be helpful to the chairman and increase the effectiveness of the council meetings. There is no provision in the bylaws for a deputy chairman to be appointed. Then the discussion points were as follows. Appointment of a deputy chairman to provide the chairman with assistance in the above areas is not the only option. He can call for assistance from other council members and or the secretary from time to time if the occasion warrants. This is usually done when assistance is needed in administrative matters and does not require any formal or official action. For example, Melbourne asks me from time to time to give some assistance with the agenda. There's certainly no need to formalise that sort of arrangement. Setting that to one side, however, it is common practice for governing boards to have a deputy chairman, and they are called upon to act, for example, in these circumstances, where the chairman is unwilling or unable to attend the meeting, where the chairman is unwilling or unable to chair a meeting. Chairman is unable to attend the meeting due to illness or another acceptable reason. The chairman has to leave to attend to other matters during a meeting. The chairman becomes ill. Hopefully not, and not be used. The chairman becomes ill during a meeting. Another one is the chairman is presenting a proposal and the board considers the meeting should be independently chaired while he does so. And an item is being discussed where the chairman has a real or potential conflict of interest. In all of those circumstances, a board normally would have a deputy chairman who simply takes over for the period of time that is needed. Continuing with the discussion points, in our case, the frequency of teleconferences increases the potential number of occasions when a deputy might be needed. Now that's specifically because of the time Melbourne does spend out of the country, and particularly because he visits areas where he simply can't contact us from time to time, either by telephone or by email. There have been times when the UCG chairman, with the approval of the council, has nominated another member to act as a temporary chairman. Such occasions have been ad hoc and usually made on short notice. This ad hoc arrangement would not be practicable, however, if an emergency occurred during a meeting and the chairman was incapacitated and unable to act. The committee believes there is ample assistance available to the chairman if he needs assistance in purely administrative matters, but it would be advantageous for him to have an appointed deputy to serve when needed, rather than the present ad hoc arrangement. As a point of comparison, the national councils in Australia and Canada both have a deputy chairman to cover these circumstances. We then came to recommendations which we would like the council to consider now. The committee is of the opinion that there is merit in formalising the appointment of a deputy to temporarily assume the position of chairman in the event that any of the examples listed above could occur. Although such occurrences may be relatively infrequent, appointment of a deputy would enable a seamless transition to be made, regardless of the particular circumstances. The committee therefore recommends that a position of deputy chairman be created. If the recommendation is accepted, the question of process must be considered. Do the bylaws need to be amended, or can the appointment be regarded as a procedural matter within the council's prerogative? Although not unanimous, a clear majority of the committee believes that the best course would be to submit a bylaw amendment to the General Conference. Before reaching that conclusion, advice was sought from legal counsel Larry Darden and Secretary Gerald Seeley. Both men recommend the bylaw amendment route, and their comments were attached to the paper that I emailed to you a couple of weeks ago. So we then have a second recommendation for the council to consider, that the council submits a proposed bylaw amendment to the General Conference recommending the creation of the position of deputy chairman, and that the council secretary and chairman of the Roles and Rules Committee, in consultation with the UCGIA legal counsel, draft a proposed amendment for approval by the council. So two recommendations. One, yes, that we do formalise the position of deputy chairman, and secondly, that we do that via a bylaw amendment to the bylaws. Now we're happy to handle any questions, comments on that. Is there general agreement to both recommendations? Well, I don't believe we need a resolution, Melvin, but I would move that the council adopt both recommendations from the Roles and Rules Committee. I'll need a second before that, then it can be adopted on a show of hands. I think Mario just beat you. Could I see all those in favour of adopting those recommendations? Thank you. The rapidity with which we deal with these matters belies the amount of time it takes to get them to you. The next item, if you can go to your agenda, is Review of Governing Documents. And it just says we'll give you a progress report on this important project. This has now been running for some time. It was a decision made by the council probably more than 12 months ago that it would be timely for us to review the governing documents of UCGIA, and namely three in number, the Constitution, the Bylaws and the Rules of Association. To get this entire project done, a project team or a government document review team was put together, and we began the process quite some time ago. However, lots of water has passed under lots of bridges since that time, so we have not made a lot of progress with this. However, I can give you a progress report, that is that we have completed a first pass through the Constitution. And about a week or so ago, I sent you a document which was the Constitution with the suggested changes or changes that could be considered to that document. You might recall that anything that was to be added to the document was in green print. Anything that was to be taken out of the document was in red print. And if there are comments we wanted you to consider, that was in blue print. Now, it's not the intention at this point in time to go through the document with you. It is still a work in progress. The purpose of me standing up here now is simply to let you know where we are, that we have gone through the first phase or the first pass of looking at the Constitution. Already we realise that when we get into looking at the bylaws, that that also may impact on what we have suggested in the Constitution. And certainly what has been suggested in the Constitution is going to have an impact in the bylaws, as John Elliott has already pointed out to us. Now, what the review team would like you to do, and perhaps I should explain the status of the review team, it is not a part of the Roles and Rules Committee. The Roles and Rules Committee was given nominal oversight of this project, and as chairman of the Roles and Rules Committee, I accepted the role of simply coordinating the work that the review team did. So that is where the Roles and Rules Committee is involved. I did explain to them at our meeting last Monday where we were with this. And of course, we'll keep them up to date because of their nominal responsibility, if you will. What I'd like you to do, if you have got time, and we already have had some feedback, as council members, if you could look at the document that we have given to you, which is a provisional pass through the Constitution, if you could, in fact, have a look at the changes that we recommend, have a look at what we said should be taken out, what should be removed, the restructuring of the document, and come back to us with any comments that you have. Mr. Holliday has already indicated he has a couple of comments to feed back to the committee, or to the review team. But emphasise once again, this is a work in progress. Immediately after this conference, we're going to begin working on the bylaws. Be a longer task than the Constitution, simply because it's a longer document to begin with, but it is much more complex in terms of looking at it from a review process. So that's simply an update where we are, but I do encourage you to read the document we emailed to you. Give us your comments, if you have them, on the changes that we're suggesting. John.
Mr. Eddington, in the light that this is going to be discussed in public forums and all, could you allay some fears of any sweeping changes to our governing documents by giving perhaps just an overview of the type of changes or the type of things that are tending to come up at this point?
Yeah.
The scope of the
change. Yeah, certainly. There are two or three, more than that, maybe four or five, proposed new articles that we believe might be needed. Perhaps before, I don't want to go into detail on those at this point in time.
Are we changing our governance?
Yeah, we are not changing in any way the governance structure of UCG by looking at the Constitution. We're simply looking at the original document, which was created back in 1995. It's now 16 years later. Circumstances have changed, structures have changed, and so forth within the church. And it may be that there are now ambiguities within the document. It may be that some of the things that have developed by practice are not precisely the way they are described in the Constitution and the bylaws. So we need to bring the documentation into line with practice, or bring the practice back into line with documentation. To do that, we need to be able to go back to the original intent of both documents. What was intended when this was written? And in some cases, we find that the original intent itself has changed. So we need to make an adjustment either to the practice or to the document. So perhaps that's what's the word I'm looking for? We're absolving any fears, if you will. Now, this is a major review of the governing structure of the church. Yes, Gary?
Well, Bill, just to allay any fears that because there's a new council or whatever that we're going to all make sweeping changes, we began a search of the documents and a purification of the documents when I was on the council in 2001, 2002, and we had almost completed doing a purification of the bylaws at that time. We hadn't yet got to the Constitution, but now we've got the Constitution. And basically, it's just trying to bring up to date some of the wording, be consistent in wording, in the way things are phrased, in the spelling. It's not a matter of radical changes being taking place.
Perhaps I could give a very simple example of what caused us to suggest a lot of changes within the document, but which really is only one change. But because this particular terminology is used throughout the document, it necessitates changes. Gerald Seelig, who was part of the review team, Gary Antion is part of the review team, Gerald suggested that we needed to define church as in the broader Church of God community, church as distinct or separate as UCGIA. And the changes we've suggested is where it simply says United Church of God, an international association, it becomes in the document UCGIA. Some changes also differentiate between the overall Church of God community and where we apply with the bylaw article or the Constitution applies specifically to UCGIA. Gerald.
Just thank you for the credit, but I wasn't the one who said that. But I picked up on it and wrote the definitions.
Okay.
I don't remember who it was that made the original recommendation, but I picked up and said, this is excellent. We need to do this.
Yeah. Well, it must have been maybe a review member of the team that did
that. I forget exactly who it was, but it wasn't me, but I added that for you.
The way the process works is that I put together a double space, or one and a half space document, and send it out to all the members of the review team and said, please feed back to me all the comments you have on the current document. That all came back to me. I consolidated that, built it into an edited document, and sent it back to the review team. And that's the stage that it's at now. When this reading is finished here, I'll do exactly the same thing with the first part of the bylaws. Create a document that's easy to work with, send it out to the review team, get their comments back, and then incorporate those comments back into a revised document. Mario.
Perhaps also to clear things up, this has been already in the works for at least 2 years, hasn't it?
This particular project, not that long, but I'd say 12 months. Okay. I'd say 12 months. We really went into sleep mode for about 6 months, actually, because of other things that were taking place. The original target was to have something to present to the council by about December of this year, but it's probably going to be toward the middle of next year, I think now, before we finish the bylaws and the rules of association. Of course, the big question that has to be answered, and we haven't really considered this, is when you look at the number of changes in this Constitution, right, and they are not changes of huge importance, When we look at the changes that will be suggested in the rules and association and the bylaws, how are we going to get these changes introduced? How are we going to get them accepted and introduced? For example, do we repeal the existing documents and just have them replaced with the new ones? That's something we'll ask the council to consider in due course. It's not a matter of a simple amendment.
Yeah, I just did a quick scan. There's not, according to the document I have in front of me, there's not been one iota changed in the fundamental beliefs. No. There's not one letter changed as far as this is concerned.
Yeah.
Just so everybody knows.
Well, in fact, the first email I sent out to the review team said, Section 2, the fundamental beliefs are not part of this process. So that's where we are. And then we'll give you a regular update at each council meeting. Okay. Melbourne, the only other item that we said we could deal with fairly quickly was a question that was also asked of the Revolves and Rules Committee. It's item number
2.19
on your agenda. Can international senior pastors be nominated as international council members? Roles and Rules was asked to consider this question, and we said a report and recommendation will be presented. In fact, we did send you a report dated July the 7th on whether US-based senior pastors could be nominated to serve on the Council of Elders. I won't go through the document in its entirety. I might go straight back to the recommendations, straight to the recommendations at the end of the document. It says there are at least two options the council could consider in order to enable senior pastors to serve as international members of the council. Firstly, the pastor's policy manual could be amended to remove the word priority wording that denies a US-based American elder the opportunity of being appointed as an international council member. In concert with this action, the council could then choose to interpret primary work in Bylaw 831 in its broadest context and remove a second potential barrier. Just to give you a slight explanation of that recommendation. For that comment. The bylaw 8.3.1, which is relevant here, uses the words primary work. It says the use of the words primary work in bylaw 8.3.1 is central to the subject under discussion. The Council of Elders shall consist of 12 members. The Council shall include at least three members whose primary work is outside the United States of America at the time of the election. Now, the abridged Oxford Dictionary defines primary as holding or sharing the first place in time, importance, or development. I think it's reasonable to say that our interpretation of primary in the context of Bylaw 8.3.1 has principally related to time. In other words, the international senior pastor would need to spend the majority of his time on those international responsibilities. If he did that, he would then be eligible to be nominated as an international member of the Council of Elders. For example, if the council considered the work done by Mark Mickelson in West Africa to be more important than his US work, he still would not be regarded as having his primary work outside of the United States because he doesn't spend most of his time in West Africa. So that's what I'm saying here, that if we remove the word priority, that restricts an international senior pastor or US-based senior pastor being nominated, then Mark could, in fact, be nominated. But it would require a bylaw change to do that. Just going back to the introduction, there are at least two options the council could consider in order to enable senior pastors to serve as international members of the council. A bylaw change could handle that if we really wanted to do that. Secondly, the council could once again consider amending bylaw 8.3.1 to provide more flexibility in the nomination of international council members. In other words, remove the words priority or primary and just restructure that to indicate in some way that a US-based senior pastor could be nominated to serve as an international member of the council. Now, having given you that outline of how it could be done, this is our recommendation. The Roles and Rules Committee does not support either of the options as stated in the preamble and recommends that the current practice be continued. In other words, that the US-based senior pastors, unless they spend all or a majority, a clear majority of their time in international areas, are not eligible to serve on the council as international members. The justification for that decision is this. If provision is made whereby US-based Americans can easily fill international positions, it would void the original intent of bylaw 8.3.1, minimise the contribution of international areas and cultures to council discussions, and serve to justify past criticism of the Americanisation of the council. If option two was pursued, the bylaw change would have to go through the amendment process, an action that would bring into the matter into sharper focus and potentially strengthen the aforementioned criticism, that is, the criticism of the Americanisation of the council. In addition to its primary recommendation, the council believes it will be helpful if the council and administration will positively encourage international participation in the time leading up to the next ballot. It is appreciated that the number of international elders who may be willing or able to serve is relatively low, but we are only seeking one elder in each year. If the council accepts the committee's recommendation, the situation could always be revisited after the 2012 experience is known. So after due consideration, and there was due consideration, the recommendation from the committee as a current practice and qualification for somebody to serve as an international member of the Council of Elders be maintained as it is and that no change be introduced. That is now for discussion. Aaron, sorry. You'd have a council of 11 men. Yeah, yeah, but it doesn't stop the council from operating, of course. Hmm. Well, we didn't get many internationals this year, but we did get more than the required number of nominees. Darius.
Does the committee have any recommendations to the council as to how to encourage greater participation?
We didn't discuss that. Now, again, we might all have individual opinions and advice on how we should do that, but I mean, we can. I hesitate to say that I encourage Bill Bradford, but Nick, the fact is, I might have said something positive to him. Yeah. I will probably live to regret that.
We don't want all those international positions filled from Australia, though. Do
we? Well, you never know. Aaron.
What if someone retired from an international area and then lived in the United States? Would they be considered having their primary work there even though they moved here? How would that work?
If they retired, they'd be depend on how their job was allocated to them over here, I guess.
I think he means if he finishes out his term.
Yeah. Not that memorial.
Yeah.
Then after that, would he be considered a U.S. elder or considered international? If he was retired from international.
Is he an international? Is he American or is he?
Well, let's take Bill's case.
Okay.
If he were to finish out his term and retire and decide to move back to the U.S., he wouldn't be employed by the U.S. and his job responsibility would be he wouldn't have any job responsibility.
Then he's a U.S., not an
international. Yeah, I would say he'd be ineligible. No question about that. Yeah.
Bill, isn't a partial solution what you're working on? Of going back to what it used to be, that every elder's name was up as a possible candidate unless they notified the secretary, remember? That's the way we started.
Yeah.
That everyone would be eligible. It was a longer list that we chose from. And then I remember it was changed to you have to submit your name as a candidate in order to be considered. I know you're taking a look at that, right, of going back to the way it was because we've had so few submit their names. right? Because a lot of the fellows that have mentioned to me is, well, it's like I'm promoting myself. And that's why some of them have not done so.
Yeah, that's a task we have to address, that nomination process.
Yeah.
People misread, I think, a little bit the way that change was made. They weren't being asked to nominate themselves to serve on the council.
Yeah.
All they were indicating was, if I was nominated, I would be prepared to serve.
Yeah.
And we felt there was certainly no manner or attitude of self-promotion in somebody putting their name forward.
I think that's correct.
Yeah, but you are right. Yeah. There have been questions raised because of the number of the small number of nominees we received.
Yeah.
But after, was it you or Victor made your appeal?
I mean, we
got a lot of people who put
so,
their name in.
So it just shows they need some encouragement that it's okay to...
Yeah.
Yeah. Submit your name.
Yeah, my personal view is that we should leave that as it is, but we could add to it and say that somebody else may nominate another member of the GCE to serve, which would open up the opportunity for that to be done.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and I think a further explanation that you're not nominating yourself, you know, so it's clear.
Yeah.
Because the reason that was done is because a lot of people who left their name on that list were not able to serve. Nobody knew them. And so you had to wait through the list and try to come up with who would you nominate.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we had in excess of 150 men to choose from for the US-based elders. And like 30 or 40 internationals, they simply didn't take their name off. There was one particular example, which may or may not be known to you, that one elder left his name in, and because he had a fairly high profile, he did not intend to leave his name in. He did not intend to withdraw his name. But it stayed on the list of potential nominees. He then went on a process of contacting people, saying, please don't vote for me, please don't vote for me. That got to that extent. Yeah. Yeah. And that's how I got onto the council.